Welcome back to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Before we dive into our first guest interview of 2023, some general announcements to share. Lungcast is now available on YouTube. You can subscribe to @Lungcast on YouTube to listen to our entire library of episodes since 2020 and watch new episodes and interview segments when they go live. A link to the show page, as well as the American Lung Association and HCP Live homepages for Lungcast, can be found in each episode description. And as always, you can subscribe to Lungcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and your favorite listening platforms, and you can register for more respiratory news and insights at both lung.org and hcplive.com. We have some great plans for year four of our show, including possibly some live episodes at major conferences, so stay tuned for details. Today, we're speaking with Dr. David Cook, professor and founding chief of the Division of General Thoracic Surgery at UC Davis Health's Department of Surgery, on a litany of topics throughout thoracic surgery, namely the particular role he and his peers play in fulfilling current standards for lung cancer care. Thank you, Dr. Cook, for speaking with me today, and thank you for being an active volunteer and a national spokesperson for the American Lung Association.
Thank you, Al.
You're welcome. To begin, will you please briefly tell our listeners how you were drawn to thoracic surgery and what your current role at the UC Davis School of Medicine involves?
Great. Thank you, Al, for the nice invite, and I'm happy to be here and talk with you. I'm the chief of general thoracic surgery at UC Davis in Sacramento, California, and I've been at UC Davis it's my 15th year. And in this role, I lead our surgical direction for the treatment of lung cancer. I helped found and develop our lung cancer screening program. It's a comprehensive lung cancer screening program. And I'm also the director of robotic thoracic surgery, which is involved with providing minimally invasive diagnostic and therapeutic care for the patient with lung cancer using robotic platforms, and also educating our next generation of thoracic surgeons in robotic technology as well. I'm also the program director for our cardiothoracic surgical fellowship, which trains the next generation on how to best care for patients with lung cancer. Mm-hmm. I've been a volunteer for the American Lung Association for over a decade, really starting off with our California Lung Association group here, and then happy to be a volunteer national spokesperson for the American Lung Association.
Well, certainly you have the best perspective to talk about some of the questions I have for you today. So that's great. So I'd like to begin our discussion with lung cancer screening. We all know that the uptake of this potentially life-saving procedure in the high-risk group identified by the USPSTF task force remains at a low level, recently quoted at about 5 to 6% nationally. I know you're involved in trying to raise awareness and move the needle on getting more individuals screened. Best practices for the implementation of lung cancer screening include the input from a multidisciplinary team. Can you describe the role as you see it of the thoracic surgeon on this team? And as a follow-up, do you feel this is a role that many of your colleagues embrace?
Sure. So the answer is to your last question, yes. Most thoracic surgeons embrace lung cancer screening. And the American Lung Association itself showed with its State of Lung Cancer report that the individuals who qualify for lung cancer screening in our country, less than 6% are actually screened. And when you compare that to mammography for breast cancer screening, over 70% of women who qualify for mammography actually get mammography. So it's that 70 versus 6. And yet lung cancer screening kills more people than breast cancer, colon cancer, and prostate cancer combined. So we have to do better. And it is done through a multidisciplinary approach. So not just thoracic surgeons, but primary care physicians, medical oncologists, radiologists, all have to work together to move the needle and increase screening. At UC Davis, we've had research projects to do that, just that, to increase screening. And we looked at in one of our primary care networks, we were able to increase screening by over 200%. And that's used with targeted patient projects. So specifically using a pre-visit planner to go through the roster of patients who will be entering this primary care site in the upcoming days, and then reaching out to those patients and saying, you know what, you qualify for lung cancer screening, and activating those patients with awareness.
Do you use your electronic record to make those identifications ahead of time? I know plenty of practices and screening centers are trying to use something like the EMRs to identify potential patients.
Yes. So through that initial study, we were able to evaluate patients based on a roster for an upcoming primary care visit. With the next iteration that's grant funded, we're looking at ways to utilize our patient portal to reach out to those patients who qualify and make it easier for them to enter a lung cancer screening process.
Great. Yeah, the less hurdles, the better. Speaking of hurdles, you know, aside from the multidisciplinary team, shared decision-making has been a part of lung cancer screening for a while. And the concept of shared decision-making, I think, is ingrained in surgical education, and surgeons guide patients through decision processes, like weighing the potential benefits and harms of surgery, as well as the alternative treatments. What are your thoughts on the surgeon's role in that regard?
Yeah, so really shared decision-making is a partnership with the clinician and the patient and their families, and really going over not just the benefits of any type of test or intervention, but the potential risks of any type of test and intervention, and going through best case and worst case scenarios. I think with lung cancer screening, it's important to understand the benefits. So there's a stage shift. Most patients in this country are diagnosed with lung cancer at stage 3 or 4, the most advanced stages. Most patients who are diagnosed with lung cancer after screening are stage 1 or 2, the best chance for cure. But there are some potential risks for lung cancer screening. For instance, a false positive. You identify an abnormality that turns out not to be lung cancer. And then there are risks with the diagnosis, whether it's needle-guided biopsy or whether it's, and then there's risk with treatment, so whether it's surgery or radiation. But it's all about informed decision-making. And the risks for lung cancer screening are less and less and less as our technology increases, increases, and increases. So it's important for patients to be informed, but shared decision-making shouldn't be a barrier to getting equitable access to population health.
And your answer kind of leads into part of my next question. During my training in pulmonary medicine, which was longer ago than I'd like to admit, we had case conferences with thoracic surgeons, and usually it involved at that time decisions around surgery or no surgery, lobar resection for cure or no resection, and almost everyone got a mediastinoscopy. Will you please speak to the changes in philosophy of lobar versus wedge versus segmentectomy, as well as you've mentioned, the changes in technology that have occurred over the last several decades? And here I'm thinking about the development of minimally invasive and robotic techniques, as well as the extension of the bronchoscopic techniques with EBUS and navigational capabilities.
Sure. So when we look at the lung anatomy, on the left lung has two parts to it, an upper part, which is called a lobe, and a lower lobe. On the right lung has three parts to it, an upper and middle lobe. That's the way it is in every human being, because as we're developing as an embryo, our heart shifts over towards the left. So when we only have space for two lobes on the left and three lobes on the right. Now, each lobe is composed of a segment. So imagine a lobe being like an orange, and you're taking a segment out of an orange. And you could actually cut each of those segments in half or take pieces, and that's called a wedge. So when you have a wedge or a segment, that's called a sublobar resection. So you can either do a lobectomy or a sublobar resection. Now, we have really exciting new data from two major clinical trials. One trial was performed in Japan, which they looked at segmentectomy versus lobectomy for tumors less than 2 centimeters in size. That's roughly the size of both my thumbnails put together. And what they found was that in those patients, there was no difference in survival or recurrence of lung cancer in the segmentectomy group. And the segmentectomy group actually did better physiologically wise. And so there was equivalence between segmentectomy and lobectomy in that population. Now there's new data from an American trial looking at sublobar resection, that's segmentectomy or wedge, just kind of taking a chunk out. And in fact, over 60% of those sublobar resection patients were a wedge and not a segment. And again, no difference in disease, cancer recurrence. And in fact, the sublobar resection patients did a little bit better. So that changes our approach and view of lung cancer in regards to how much lung we actually need to take out. And this is similar to what we learned in breast cancer years ago. We went from something called a radical mastectomy back in the 40s and 50s, where we took muscle and breast tissue and skin out. Then we went to a modified radical mastectomy, where we preserved the muscle, but still took out all this tissue. And in appropriate patients, we moved from modified radical mastectomy to what's called needle localization and lumpectomy, just taking a bit of the breast cancer out, and in this case, augmenting with radiation. And so we're going to see a similar monumental shift in the surgical approach for lung cancer, and that is with smaller wedges or segmentectomies for smaller tumors, giving people an equal chance for cure. Now, we could do this minimally invasively, whether it's video-assisted thoracic surgery or robotic surgery. And now we have the ability to mark little tiny tumors with what's called navigational bronchoscopy. And that's using either electromagnetic navigation or robotic navigation, partnering with our interventional pulmonology colleagues. So these are really exciting advances in the technology for eradicating lung cancer in appropriately staged patients.
Right. Aside from the role of the CAT scan in imaging, are there still the role of other nuclear medicine techniques such as PET scans? Is that still an important part of the staging process?
Yeah, so we have what's called PET CT scans. So what a PET CT scan does, it takes a sugar molecule, glucose, and attaches a harmless piece of radioactivity to it. Now, cancer cells can be very metabolically active, so they like to eat up sugar. So we could take advantage of this. We can inject this into your arm, put you into a specialized CAT scanner, and basically see what glows. And our technology has improved so much in radiology, whether it's CT scans and looking at not just the diameter of a nodule, but also its volume. And that has helped us into minimizing false positive rates in lung cancer screening. But advances in PET technology has been able to increase our pretest probability of something being a cancer or not. And so we minimize the exposure to patients who may not have cancer and minimize the invasive procedures in patients who may not have cancers.
This is usually done well before any surgical approach. Biopsy?
Yes, very much so. And in partnership with our radiology colleagues as part of a multidisciplinary team.
Right. Getting back to lung cancer screening a bit, we know the main driver of this procedure is to shift the stage of lung cancer to an earlier stage, which is potentially more curative. Unfortunately, in clinical practice, many patients present with metastatic stage 4 disease right now. It's recognized this stage 4 group is a heterogeneous group. And despite all being characterized as stage 4, some patients have a higher disease burden compared to others. And in 2017, the updated TNM staging reclassified metastatic disease into three different groups, M1A, M1B, and M1C, because of median survival differences. Do you see this as changing the approach from a thoracic surgery standpoint to this group of individuals?
Yes, because I think those changes were made to identify a population of patients who have what's called oligometastatic disease, oligo meaning few, and disease that's metastasized to one site. So for instance, if someone has an isolated brain metastasis and otherwise early stage lung cancer, other than that isolated metastasis, so no cancer in their lymph nodes, Then that single metastasis to the brain could be treated with focused beam irradiation, and then their lung cancer is appropriately treated with surgery. Same thing with an isolated metastasis to a gland that sits on top of the kidney called the adrenal gland. Now that isolated metastasis may be treated with radiation or with a combination of our surgical oncology colleagues to do a laparoscopic adrenalectomy. And then if there's no other sites of disease, including no disease in the lymph nodes, then their otherwise early stage lung cancer is treated surgically. So that really provides us with a additional armamentarium to treat our appropriately staged patients. But those decisions really need to be part of a multidisciplinary tumor board, a multidisciplinary team, and those treatment decisions shouldn't be made in a vacuum.
Right. So lung cancer patients are living longer these days due to earlier staging, as we just talked about with lung cancer screening. There's also treatments with targeted therapies and immunotherapy that have prolonged survival. And follow-up with these patients often ultimately does develop recurrent disease. Can you talk about your role as a thoracic surgeon as far as following your patients after their diagnosis and what the role might be for surgical intervention at a later date when recurrence does occur?
Yeah, so this really shows that it's an exciting time to be a general thoracic surgeon. And really the technology and advancements and innovation in the care of cancer that has led to that drop of mortality over the past 20 years really elevates the importance of a thoracic surgeon who understands the data and understands what needs to happen. For instance, there are four FDA-approved next-generation medications for patients with surgically resectable disease. For instance, we have what's called neoadjuvant or upfront immunotherapy regimens for patients just before they undergo surgery. And we have three FDA-approved adjuvants, so after-treatment recommendations, two of which are immunotherapy and one of which is targeted therapy for a mutation in a tyrosine kinase receptor or EGFR. And so that means that we have to understand what tissues need to go for next generation sequencing and what tissues need to be analyzed for PD-L1 or immune surface marker analysis, and really partner with our medical oncologists for patients who ordinarily wouldn't see a medical oncologist. So we have to be aware of when to send a referral and et cetera. We have to, we as thoracic surgeons do 5-year surveillance in patients who undergo surgery and may not undergo systemic therapy. And we follow them every 6 months for 2 years and once a year for 3 years for 5 years total. And if they should recur, we work with a multidisciplinary team to manage that recurrence. And then when they graduate from our practice, do they still qualify for lung cancer screening? And if they do, then we do shared decision-making at that point. And then we do lung cancer screening annually until they age out. So it's really exciting to be a general thoracic surgeon because it's not just cut and sew, but it's really granular thought processes and team building and coalition building, all for the betterment and restoration of health of our patients.
Now you certainly keep bringing apart the importance of multidisciplinary and collaboration with other specialties. And absolutely, that is what we see as a best practice. Now, we know across the country, unfortunately, not every institution or every patient has access, but we need to try to improve the standard of care throughout. Before we move to the next question, you mentioned the neoadjuvant therapy. Do you find patients reluctant to sometimes wait for their surgery while they're getting neoadjuvant therapy ahead of time?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think we now have extension of neoadjuvant therapy, so systemic treatment before surgery, for earlier stage patients. So when you're more an advanced stage patient, if you have cancer in your lymph nodes or your tumor is a very large size, you're more than willing to wait and have systemic treatment to sort of shrink that burden. But we have data to show that, you know, patients with who don't have cancer in lymph nodes and have a, you know, decent sized tumor, but not terribly large, would benefit from a neoadjuvant treatment with plus or minus chemotherapy and immunotherapy prior to surgery. And so some patients are like, I just want to get this tumor out of me. And there's options for that. And because there are options for treatment after surgery as well. And so that's where, you know, shared decision making, you discussed that earlier, of sitting down with a patient and their families and figuring out what's the outcome that's most important to them. And some patients say, yes, let's try neoadjuvant therapy, or let's try this clinical trial. And other patients were, let's just move forward with this standard care option and move forward with surgery quickly.
Right. The options are there. So although the goal is certainly to cure one's lung cancer, we know that that cannot always be the case. Can you tell us how the thoracic surgeon can help with palliation in some patients with advanced disease? And here I'm particularly thinking about the management of malignant pleural effusions.
Yeah, so a thoracic surgeon can be really beneficial for patients with malignant pleural effusions. So malignant pleural effusion is when the lung cancer infiltrates the lymphatic system of the space around the lung. That's called the pleural space. And that space around the lung is covered with a separate organ that's called the pleura. The pleura is very influential in regulating that lymph fluid. Now, when that lymphatic channels get filled with cancer, the pleura is unable to absorb that fluid in a timely manner, and fluid can build up, and that's called a malignant effusion. What thoracic surgeons could do one of two things. One is we can infiltrate a scarring solution into that pleural space, which is basically medical grade talcum powder, and that can create scar between the lung and the surrounding chest wall, and that prevents the fluid from building up and allows the patient's lymphatic system time to reabsorb that fluid. So that's one case. Sometimes the lung is kind of trapped, almost like a raisin, and is unable to expand. In that case, a thoracic surgeon or an interventional pulmonologist can put what's called a TPC, or tunneled pleural catheter, which is designed to be comfortable for the patient and designed to be infectious resistant. And that way, the patient can drain themselves of that malignant effusion, so they don't have to frequently encounter the healthcare system for needle drainage. They could do it in the comfort of their own home. And those are two options where a thoracic surgeon and also an interventional pulmonologist can be beneficial in the palliative treatment of patients.
Right. So with the changing landscape of lung cancer care, as we've talked about, with the screening, the improved therapies, longer survival, and certainly the newer technologies of diagnostic and therapeutic approaches, what are some of your thoughts as far as what's on the horizon for thoracic surgery and lung cancer care?
Yes. So expansion of robotic surgery is on the horizon. So really, it's become easier to perform a segmentectomy and a wedge using robotic techniques. It's just the matter of going through smaller incisions, looking through anatomic planes, and et cetera. Combination with navigational bronchoscopy, we can mark little tiny tumors with bioluminescence. So they glow, and we can identify and resect those. And then in the future, we will layer artificial intelligence onto that. So we will collect data of really high volume surgeons such as myself around the country who do robotics. And then we could do, just like your car has augmentation to it to help the driver be more safe, we will have augmentation on these robotic platforms to help the surgeon be more safe and more accurate in removing these lung cancers.
Well, you've given us a great perspective on all things lung cancer and surgery related. So again, thanks to Dr. Cook for his time and insights today. We've discussed the subject of lung cancer diagnosis and intervention a lot on LungCast. So anyone interested in learning more should also check out our past interviews with Dr. Carla Lamb, Dr. James Molstein, and Dr. Mazzocchi in the show notes below. Be sure again to subscribe and rate LungCast on your preferred listening or watching platform, and visit lung.org and HCP Live for more news and resources. Until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters, so just take it one breath at a time.